This is in fact class 3 in module 17 of looking at self and selflessness, which we began 3 weeks ago with the talk with, maybe 4 weeks ago, with the talk with Erica, who introduced the topic to us. And last week we listened to a tape by Pema Chodron about one aspect of self and selflessness. And so I'm going to pick up there and really just review what she did, and then we'll have a discussion. Then I'd also like to offer a little meditation kind of experience of the self, and we have time to discuss that as well. I also want to express my appreciation. I have learned so much from you and in this context over the last couple of years. It reminds me of the way the Heart Sutra works, right? The Buddha is meditating. Avalokiteshvara has studied and is practicing. And then the student who asked the question evokes this terrific insight. And so that's how I think about this group and how I'd like to think about the discussion. So let me start with the story. This last weekend, I spent some time with some friends' kids, and we take them Christmas shopping every year. And it's a lot of fun. They're 9 years old, and you never know what they're going to say. You never know what they're going to get for their parents. It's eye-opening. And there's a moment when, and they're twins, right, boy and girl. And so Sophie said, we were on our way to see a movie, she said, if there's someone who's embarrassed in the movie, Theo's going to be embarrassed. And Theo started doing this. And she said, yeah, he gets embarrassed when anybody gets embarrassed. And he fessed up that that is in fact him. And I thought, oh, look at that. He's only 9 years old and already has a self. No doubt it started sooner than that. But he was already aware that what it's like to be him is to have an emotional reaction to certain encounters that make him feel small. And so And it really helped me think about sort of why we begin with the self, because it's the place where we begin to enter into an understanding of what we've learned from experience, how the self works, but how we might question it, and in questioning it, begin to see that it's not quite what we thought it was all along. So the three qualities that Pema talked about in the talk last week that are the traditional ways of thinking about the self is that our nervous system works in such a way that we think of it, we make certain assumptions that lead us to believe that it is separate, we are separate, that we are solid or singular, and finally permanent, usually the other way around, actually permanent, solid, singular, and separate. And really impermanent, that doesn't surprise us, right? And in fact, if you've been reading the Kenpo Rinpoche Progressive Stages of Meditation on Emptiness, you might have come across his point about what it's like to think about permanence. The question isn't really whether the person or personality or ego is a changing composite train of events conditioned by many factors, because any rational analysis shows that this is the case. The question is, why do we then behave emotionally as if it were a lasting, single, and independent thing? So when we're looking for the self, it's very important to remember that it is an emotional response that one's examining. Just like Theo and his embarrassment. And because if you look in the mirror, I can't see my beard going gray, but every couple of weeks I trim it a little bit shorter because it seems to be grayer. So I know that, but day by day I don't take that in. I don't feel it. So here are a couple of facts you also know. We're 60% water. I feel like the same person I walked in to this room as last week, but I'm 60% water. 60% of me, at least, has completely changed. I don't know that, and I assume that because the experience of walking in last week feels a lot like this week, that nothing has changed. This idea of solid, I found a little bit harder. And Pema had this great way of thinking about us as lumps. We tend to lump ourselves into a single thing at a time, right? And I hope I'm not being indulgent here, but this happened to me today. I had this experience today, so I'll share this. I was working with a team, which is part of my work as a leadership coach, and they said that things weren't going well for them. There was actually this undercurrent of anger and tension. And I had been there for the conversation where this had developed. When they told me that they needed to go back to that and fix it and work on it, and I knew I'd been there and I hadn't fixed it for them, I felt like one thing. I felt solid all of a sudden, just, and I felt failure. That was a while ago. It's better, but it's, and all of a sudden that was all I was, and I got smaller and smaller, and oh, the emotional reaction. I could go into that, but I think the important thing is that it was the reaction that caught my attention. It felt really, really familiar, and for about a second, I admitted to myself that it felt awful in a way that made me feel at ease, because it was so familiar. I thought, I'm that person, that's all I am, this is my reaction. Now I can get out of this. Now I can step away from this. I don't have to worry about it anymore because I felt awful. The whole cycle is complete for me. And this is why looking into solid and separate and permanent can be helpful, because we can begin to question, well, am I really just failing? Is that feeling the only reaction available here? And it's a question. It's a genuine question that I think we investigate for ourselves. You know, and the last one is separate, which even Pema says is harder to get, and I kind of agree. But one thing that occurred to me before I share, you know, her insight about it, that I got thinking about, if you think about driving into traffic, I mean, think, for example, of going into traffic at Alewife at 5 o'clock, right? Speaking of emotional reactions. When you move into there, you think of yourself in your car, it's just me, everything's fine. But every move you make and every move everybody else makes affects everybody in that situation. Mm-hmm. So purely on the physical level, we're all in this together, and every move affects every other move. Now, if you factor into that people who might be yelling or flipping you off or rushing up behind you, I never do that. But then that adds a whole other emotional dimension to that interaction, where that is also communicated to everyone in the mix. So you can begin to get a feel for what it might be like not to exactly be separate. Pema went on with this fascinating idea that I just offer, because I'm still certainly just beginning to work with it. She says, if when we hear something, it's worth thinking about, is what I hear different from, or really, really separate from how I hear it, what my ear hears, and the way my mind is working with what's heard? And if all of those things are connected, then am I really separate? I know it was a fascinating thing to reflect on. So the last thing I want to offer is that I want to put in a good word for the self, because we often talk about it as ego, and we think about it as enemy. And I know for me, as a former Christian, it feels like the ego is that awful part, the sinner, and a bad idea, a bad thing, something exclusively to be gotten rid of, and to be and is an antagonist. But it seems to me, the way I understand the teaching, it's just how we are. It's just our reaction to the regular world and our nervous system not yet being accustomed to doing anything else but triggering that emotional reaction. So that's just a little review to bring all that back to mind. But I would be really curious to hear how you've been thinking about or reflecting on or encountering permanent, solid or singular and separate.
And maybe mention independent is also what's used as the third one.
Right. So
Pema uses separate, but Kenpo and most of the other teachers use independent. So don't be thrown off by that.
You can also call it autonomous.
Autonomous, the last one.
Right. And so the alternative would be independent or
independent or
interdependent. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. The other side of it. Sorry.
Yeah.
And I like what you said about the sort of knowing that we're not permanent and yet not feeling. Because I think that's a piece, because you always look and say, well, clearly I'm not permanent. And an interesting conversation with Erica, because when she taught that first class, I was kind of tired, and I thought, she's not teaching the way she usually does. Maybe I'm just kind of tired, and I'm just not noticed. So I actually listened to it again when I was more alert, and I said, no, she sounded different. And I thought, oh, Erica's not permanent. Not always the same. So I, myself, I might still be permanent, but Erica is. But it's that kind of piece, because that's, you know, we have like part of why we, I think we hold on to that is because we want to know that I can go deal with the person and that they're going to be this way.
Exactly.
And I'm not going to deal with that person because they're always that way. And we get very attached to sort
that's
of knowing. The one thing of them is something, but even just I know what they're going to do, so I'm not even going to go ask. I'm just going to, you know, I'm not going to do what I want to do because they're never going to agree with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with your partner, it's really easy to get into those patterns of, you know, you're always this way about this.
Right.
And the thing I liked, Dan, just a few minutes ago when you talked about something positive about the ego or something. And during the week, I felt being gentle and friendly to the ego was, you know, something that takes away the threat of what happened at Vulture Mountain. A few of them had heart attacks or something, you know, and if they were a little friendlier to the ego, they might have lived a little longer. Also, if I could share one other thing too, is about the solidity thing. And again, what you just shared in a few minutes, like your own personal thing, was just kind of gelled with me. I couldn't speak as a kid, and so eventually, you know, in school they put me into a couple of years of speech therapy, which had to take a deep breath and all that. And it was terrific because it allowed me to calm down a little bit. Also, it allowed other people to talk. So I was quite happy with that. But the point of solidity was a transient spark right through me. It shut me right up. And it still does. And people say, well, you don't stutter. Well, that's because I know how to dance all around it. But when I get threatened, like in front of a judge or something like that, that's a perfect description of it. So it's.
And does that feel like? Do you notice whether it feels like you get bigger or get smaller?
Absolutely smaller.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I vanish.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't do anything. I just freeze. And it only happens for maybe less than a second now. It used to happen, you know, long term. But it's fundamentally the same thing. It's solidity. It's a great term. Great term for it.
And we use the word freezing, you know, freezing the fluidity when we talk about, we talk about grasping.
Grappling with this kind of stuff
made me think about something I'm doing with a group of people, and there was a physics teacher that came in and was speaking to us. We were looking at the nature of time. And I don't pretend to know entirely, I couldn't follow everything, but from what I can grasp is that, you know, the whole universe, it was one, it was, there was no separateness. You know, it was all, you know, this hot, it was hot, this molten. And then there was coolness that came in and things spread out. And so there was, you know, some diversity, if you will. And now we're apparently in this place called the Goldilocks Zone, where it's neither too hot or neither too cold. But in terms of time, apparently, from what I understand in the physics world, that time has a direction and it's entropy. It's going towards entropy. And how does this relate to all of this stuff? Because it really is looking at the question of same and difference and expansion and contraction and hot and cold. And so when I think of that stuff, I think of the duality, you know? And yet, where everything came from, and ultimately where everything apparently is going to be in sameness, you know? And so I feel like that kernel of truth is carried through all of us in some way, of the sameness that we all come from. And I'm not sure it makes any sense to anyone, but so this, in some ways, for me, it's a given that we're all the same, but I think the thing that, where I probably get tripped up, is believing that it's that it is permanent, that it is for real, and that it's never going to change. And that's another thing about the nature of time, is that the only way we have any consciousness of any of time ever really being itself is if things change. And the only way we can understand that is because we have consciousness. And it's because of consciousness that we actually can observe change and time. So all of these things are kind of moving around in my head as it relates to this kind of stuff. It somehow talks to one another. I can point to it, but I can't always articulate it. But so I notice it's a great relief, actually, to feel like to be in that place of expansiveness. It's a great relief, you know, and then to contemplate the nature of
Aliyah.
It's not the word itself.
And that that it gives the opportunity for some levity in any moments of intense feeling, you know.
Yeah. I find it interesting that as I'm interviewing people for a job opening at my company, how I'm looking for things like stability, reliability, consistency, which is interesting because we even go so far as to determine whether or not somebody is trustworthy based on whether or not we can rely on them. On their consistency. And the moment that they, you know, shred that definition that we have created for them of who they are, they suddenly ding us. And we have this small sense of betrayal that person is not who we thought they were. So I think it's interesting that as creatures of change, how we are still keep going back inside of us to the place of comfort, which is that the person who we know and rely on is reliable, which means they're consistent and that they don't change.
Or they only change. Maybe they do change and they develop.
Right, but I'm saying, but we always want them to change in a good way. We want them to change. You know? So, and obviously I think we do want to see that. We can all sit here and talk about how good change is, but it's like we don't like the bad surprises, but we do like the good surprises.
That actually brings to mind the career I've had for a number of years that I'm winding down right now, where I've basically been paid well to keep a whole bunch of bitmaps looking exactly the same for 15 years, and that, you know, like avoiding change has been the main task that I've been responsible for, and I've also been, you know, the other thing about this time in my life is that there is this well-defined role that, you know, an unchanging engineering manager managing an unchanging product, and I at this point don't actually know what the discrepancy is between that definition of Sandra and the one that's sitting here now. And so it's one of the things to explore.
That's so interesting because I remember getting out of a career where, because I sat around at one point and going, I don't care. I mean, basically, you know, because it was in marketing and management kind of world where you always had to have the latest products and be on top of, you know, the newest, this, that, and the other, and teach it and stuff. And so I just thought, I don't care about being on top of these products and these, you know, it became so clear to me that the nature of trying to harness and control, you know, that element of change, you know, so that it was marketable and blah, 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 was just too much to bear for me. Yeah.
So I'm curious about that in particular because I'm willing to bet other people have had a similar experience. You were in the middle of one situation, and you thought, "Wait, no, actually, I have changed," and that led to something.
Big time.
Yeah, I wonder if others noticed that they, at some point, there was whatever that was. It seemed like it wasn't changing. Wasn't it had, and action was required.
My first marriage.
Yeah.
Details on request.
There's a coffee group.
I'd add to that is when somebody who you haven't seen in a while says, "Wow, you've changed." And you're like,
"Or you haven't."
Yeah, we haven't. But what's most surprising to me was, my youngest daughter is taking French at Cornell, and she had to talk about each of her family members in French. And I took 3 years of French, so we had a tough time, but I pieced it together when she chose a sentence about me, and she said that I was very calm and patient. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, all right. So I asked more around that. She goes, "Well, you meditate, and you actually are a lot more patient." Like, okay, comparatively. But just that she chose those words, and then we talked, we had this great discussion about her perception of my change and how she's changed as well. But it was interesting just to hear that and get this kind of like a little wake-up call. Like, yeah, okay, yeah, like we can go with that. So sometimes, yeah, or that you haven't changed. And someone says you haven't changed, you think, I've changed.
Well, everything's changing endlessly now. Mm-hmm. And now, and now, and now. And what we're saying is that when we rub up against our resistance to that, mm-hmm. is when everything freezes, right? Mm-hmm. And we terrify ourselves and our world. You know, sort of just holding on like this. And everything becomes solidified, frozen, solidified.
Yeah, one of the things that was Pema quoted somebody else was that the self is that which resists what is.
Could you repeat that?
The self is that which resists whatever is. So what it seems that the assumptions we're making that get us to feeling permanent, solid, singular, and independent has to do with encountering whatever is the change now and now and now, the separateness, the or independence or interdependence, and the fluidity, right, the opposite of all those things, and either grabbing it because we're like, oh, I like this part of it, I want that, or saying no, I don't want that, no. And mostly that's happening really like on some subtle gut level, right? This is, now we're talking about Viscanda, is one of my favorites. and from those, we build assumptions. The assumptions build habits. Habits build these identities. Identities like, I'm not good at my job, or I'm the one who helps, or I'm the one who's kind, or I'm the one who's generous. And we hang on to those as a whole amalgam.
Lump ourselves.
And lump ourselves.
So to speak.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question? How is the separateness different from the impermanence? Because it seems like things are, if everybody's connected, we're all connected, and there's this sort of, well, connection, like, you know, there's a butterfly effect.
Yeah.
You know, there's butterfly with its wings, and we're all affected by it. That's that's going to change, and that affects permanence. So they're sort of the same thing. I mean, maybe it's just the pedagogy of the Dharma that you have to separate things to understand them.
Well, I think for permanence, there's also sort of the like long term and short term. But I think they, I don't remember the one of the terms is subtle impermanence. You know, so there's the moment to moment impermanence as well as the long term. And I think that everything changes. I think it's easier to see perhaps the long term impermanence rather than that the self changing pretty much every second and that the
So I came across one of the ways Ken McLeod describes this. He talks about how everything takes form, endures, and then passes away. So I'm just going to wonder out loud whether impermanence has more to do with the changing of form, which would make it different from being interdependent.
There was, I don't know if it was in this reading or in things that we've assigned or something I just heard. It talked about impermanence, believing, you know, kind of solidifying into permanence, that sort of things are going to go on the same forever, is confusion about time. Whereas singular or solid was confusion about objects. So now that's an interesting.
I think that may have been in the Punlop reading.
Yes, the Punlop reading, yes. And then I forget what the third one was. Was it confusion about cause and effect? Cause and condition?
I think so.
Uh-huh. Okay, so I think there might be something more in there we could all explore in the reading. Go back and look at the Punlop Rinpoche reading, maybe.
And those are both on the website.
Yes, those are on the website. Okay. Right.
I think he spoke about confusion about time.
Time.
Confusion about space.
Oh, space.
Huh.
So that would be objects.
Space. Objects, I remember. And maybe the third was causes and conditions.
And time goes forward, as we know.
There we go.
Yeah, time, space. That's Planck's concept.
Yeah. I think part of the whole thing about the permanence and change is we actually, what we want to acknowledge is we change, like I'm better at that, and I'm nicer now, and I'm calmer than I used to be. But we don't want to be like, and my knees don't work as well. My digestion isn't what it used to be. We don't want those. So it's like, yeah, change is fine as long as it's all this way and none of it's this or that.
Right.
Or, you know, out of my control kind of change.
Right.
Like.
Right.
I've found, too, getting older, it's really easy to become more rigid. You know, you just... It's like I get, I used to be more bendable. I, you know, not just
literally,
physically more bendable, but but my ideas sometimes, you know, I can, in some ways, maybe I can be more open, but in other ways, I'm like, ah, I'm tired of, you know, listening to this. I'm just going to, you know, lock it off. But anyway, I'm really glad to hear the self get a break. I was glad last week, Emma and John, you know, because I'm like, okay, there's no self, and I'm like going around feeling like I have a self, and I'm like, well, what's wrong with me? You know, and
I mean, I think a lot of the when they say there's no self, when they say it doesn't exist, they're using a relatively technical definition of doesn't exist, and I think that's actually sort of important that there's a it doesn't, it's not completely independent, it's not permanent, and it's not singular, and that is not a conventional definition of existence that may, you know, that they're calling that true existence, but you know, it's a way of working away at some of the other assumptions about the self, but you know, it seems to be a definition that maybe comes from long debates in the, you know, in these, you know, between the Hindu schools and the Buddhist schools, where a lot of these thoughts were developed. So you know, you have to sort of read the asterisks. The definition of what they mean by exists can vary depending on the text.
Well, I'm just glad it gets a break.
Yeah.
You know, it's not really a much of a break, though, so don't get it.
Well, in fact, like Pamela was saying, it's okay to feel that way.
Yeah.
Well, like we feel that way.
Well, that's
like
where we start.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you still have, but you have to go deeper than that, because you're mistaken. That's the point.
So you actually
we make
a
mistake.
Change.
Yeah. But I think the first thing I heard was, oh, you feel like you have a self that's bad.
No,
what John heard.
No,
you know?
And no one ever said that.
We never said that.
No, but I immediately feel like, you know, anyway, it's good for me that it gets a break. So.
Well, I'm reminded of the quote from the Zen, long ago, Zen teacher Dogen that she quoted that I've taken so much comfort in. You know, to know the self is to forget the self.
Yeah.
And to forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. So the self is the way to selflessness, or a gateway. And it's available, and it's very available.
My name's John. I'm new with all this, and what you just said about the self and the change and everything, I've been on this earth for a little over 50 years, and the last 100 days or so have profoundly changed my life. And that's probably insignificant to 50-some-odd years that I've been here, but the last 100 days or so, I belonged to another fellowship, and I was at a meeting yesterday, and there were several young men and a young woman there, and that they could see the change in me, and that I'm not the same person I was over that 100 days ago and whatnot, and how I presented myself and how aware I am. And I was aware enough to notice a change in them, that with the way I have changed, that it had an effect on them, and you know, and that for the better, and you know, it was just a really good awareness of something that's happened between people, and it was just like I'm not going to say spiritual level, but it was just, I could see it in the eyes, and then the conversation after of, you know, that change is good, and, mm-hmm. and to be aware of it, and that bad part is like, I don't want to forget it because I don't want to go back to what it was.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm very aware, and, you know, I try to listen as much as I can and suck it all up like a sponge. I'm a pupil, all right? I do appreciate the pat on the back for just trying to go with the chair. Welcoming back and being the change and being aware of it and feeling better for it is just, I don't know, I just feel fantastic, and I'm not that person I was over 100 days ago.
Nor the person you walked in the door. That's actually even what we're talking about,
right.
Exactly that. That even this second is now. This second is now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the same second as the second. You're not the same you who walked through even the door even. So it's...
Or started that sentence.
And I can't figure out where to breathe in the Heart Sutra either.
Just don't hold your breath.
I can't say Avalokita, whatever it is. Avalokiteshvara.
Can I sort of one other thing about the self existing or not existing? I'm thinking that I think a lot of this is sort of to loosen your preconceptions rather than necessarily for you to just sit here and go, okay, it's all gone, I believe it. I think a lot of the work is it's intellectual arguments to loosen your viewpoints to perhaps allow something else to sneak in around the edges.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
that we can't pin down either.
Right.
Actually.
Right, because we keep wanting to pin down even what they give us.
We really try so hard to pin everything down over and over again.
It also seems like the teachings keep coming back to saying, well, you're going to get solid again. You know, even if you become not solid, then there's a gap of breathing between in your meditation, you're still going to come back, and you're still going to have this sense of self that is solid. Mm-hmm.
There was a quote in the reading.
Get away from it for a while.
There was a quote in the reading actually that said, "Don't worry about losing yourself. And come back."
On the other hand, it's still the case that it never was.
So here's what interests me about the kind of meditation we're going to dip into tonight, but look at more closely in coming days. The self isn't, may never, I don't know what it would be like if it went away. I don't know. Somebody else would have to tell you what that's like. But the practice, as I understand it anyway, I'm not sure I've been there, but as I understand it, is that we question whether the self is solid in these ways, and then when we get a glimpse, we sort of rest in that. And that simple, brief exercise cultivates a kind of confidence that we get it. We don't live there, but we get it, and we go back there, we go back there, and we put these glimpses together and become confident that this is true by our own discovery. And that is very hopeful to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's well
put. I could relate to that. I mean, even the example that you were giving when we were at work and, you know, somebody said something to you or in any situation, and bringing the attention to non-self, you start to realize that there's nothing there, and if you get one glimpse of it, it's just repeating that frequency, because it's such that emotional reactivity is so part of our existence,
yeah.
existence that we all share, but I think we've all had one situation where we just felt something really strong and real and solid, and then you're like, you almost laugh. You're like, this is laughable. You know, this is, there's nothing there. It's just, you know, constantly doing it over and over.
What if we did it over now? Now that, in the same talk, Hema offered a couple of really quick meditations to help the participants at the retreat get a kind of a to investigate and have potentially an encounter with what the self is and to recognize it. So if you like, I'd like to offer it for you. So get yourself into a sitting position where you feel like you're. So let's say you could do shamatha. We'll do that for just a moment, and then I'll ask a question. And the purpose here is just to pay attention and see if you notice, see what you notice, and see if you notice either of those kind of feelings. So let's just settle in and pay attention to the breath for a moment. Okay, now think of a part of your body that you like. What happens to your sense of self? Or just notice what you experience. And now think of a part of your body that you do like. What happens to your sense of self? Would anyone like to comment?
Think about my knee. It's a replacement knee now, but it's kind of painful. But the joy I had in making it painful, playing baseball and football and traveling across the country in my tournament teams and stuff when I was younger until it popped. But it was a lot of fun. And I would probably change it for the world, you know. But now it's a replacement knee. And it still works, but it's not the same. But so, I like it.
So is this something you don't like about your body? Or you do?
It's one on my face. Because I put a lot of scars on it when I grew up. I've got scars all over it, and I look in the mirror sometimes. And the way I lived and the things I've done, and the self-loathing, the self-hurt that I put myself through, and the pain that I put myself through, and inflicting pain also. But I have so many scars on my face.
And when you thought about it, did you notice
your reaction? Yeah, my heart got
heavy. Your heart got heavy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it did.
Yeah. Anybody else?
I think I tend to focus on the parts of my body that give me trouble and make me feel like all the change that we're not looking forward to is happening and it's just going to keep going that way. And so to think of something I like, it's like, oh no, I'm okay. I mean, sort of this funny, like, oh no, I'm an okay person, as opposed to, oh, my feet hurt, my neck, you know. That it's sort of, who I am is like this totally different person, just depending on what I thought about, what part of myself I thought.
So I'm interested in your reaction, because when you described it, you said, these are the things I like about myself.
Right.
And then you said, and then there's other things I don't like.
Right, yeah, okay. No, that's right. Yeah, it's all, like John said, it's in your body and your heart and how you feel.
Yeah, you get access to it there too.
I have a routine I do before my meditation.
I do some stretching, and then I do some posture work, and I pay attention, because I'm a physical therapist by training, and I pay attention to the bones and the muscles, and like a lot of times I feel like a, you know, an old clunker who needs two new knees and has enough metal in my back to sink a ship. But, you know, when I realize, like, oh God, my fingers work, and, you know, even with a surgery, I can hold a pen, I can write, and this is like, I can still stand up, isn't this great? You know, I can really appreciate the fact that my body works at all. That's, yeah, just to be able to walk down the street.
I noticed, I was first thinking about my finger, and I noticed when I was thinking about my finger, not looking at it, but thinking about it, my sense of my finger got larger, more well-defined, more solid, more colorful. Like, and then when I was thinking about something I didn't like, sort of my sense of self got more dispersed and less solid. Like it was not as real. Like this experience of it as being less. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is.
There's an interesting book that I was reading recently about, don't ask me the name of it because I won't remember, but it was about, it's a true story about a professor in Israel, a man who, I think it's confusing for me because it goes back and forth in time and I can't keep track of that, but I'm pretty sure he's a professor in Israel, and he decides at the age of 40-something to marry with kids, to undergo the whole gender reassignment procedure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something that he's known since he was a kid, but denied his whole life until he gets into his 40s and decides that it's either suicide or I do something about this. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of fascinating to read it from the perspective of the conversation that goes on in here, because his whole, and from my perspective with rediscovering who I am post-injury, his whole, there's so much discussion about what is me, what is self, what was I, what am I, what am I going to become, you know, is that ever solid? I mean, it's just, it's sort of very much this, you know, that we're talking about, but in a very sort of real life example.
I exercise every day, and I think for me it's when I have an injury that draws an awareness to my body, and I don't think I would really say that it's that I don't like the body part, I don't like being injured. And so there's a, I found that if I really sink into it, there's a sense of loss there, a loss of functionality and power, body power. Mm-hmm. And when I have a good workout and everything's working well and those injuries are minimal at that time, I feel very powerful, very alive is the term, and strong.
This is me.
That's right. Not that injured person who needs to take it easy. You know, so I, years ago I get angry, you know, but now there's just this a subtle sense of loss and like, all right, and there's also though the awareness that this too can be temporary. It might not go away, but in my experience, most of it does. It just takes a much longer time.
Yeah. Now.
But it's I don't know if it's so much as don't like as much as there's loss there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
So would you be willing to try this again?
Sure.
A little different variation. So again, the purpose of this is to get in touch with that gut level kind of the sort of clinging that spirals into habits, that spirals into identities that we cling to. So take a moment and breathe and pay attention to your breath. Now, think about being criticized or blamed. What happens to your sense of self? And now think about being praised. Maybe you can remember a situation. What happens to your sense of self? Anyone care to comment?
Mm-hmm. Being blamed and finding that I could not explain or justify myself had a sense of powerful contraction. Mm-hmm. And then finding that it was possible to simply move beyond that without knowing that I couldn't fix it was more liberating. Mm.
Liberating, that's a great word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking about, I feel that when I'm praised, incident to when I'm praised and when I'm blamed, the sense of self actually expands in both cases, but the quality of the expansion is different. Mm-hmm. With the praise, it's a more continuous expansion, and when there's blame, it's sort of like spikes extending mm-hmm. outward, but that in both cases it's a fairly strong response, and the sense of self becomes larger in response to the external stimuli. I also want to comment that you said, remember a case when you were blamed and remember a case when you were praised, if you can think of that. And that was an interesting distinction, that the blame was easier to, would be easier to locate in your formulation.
Now you're in my mind. Last night in another class where we talked about an exercise in there where you actually could try this rather than simply have it suggested from outside, is to actually stand in front of the mirror and first completely praise yourself to the skies and talk about how wonderful a person you are and how magnificent and impressive you are and how great everything is going, and see the state of mind. Check out your state of mind while you're doing this, and then really get on your case and just completely cut yourself out and, you know, totally throw yourself into a state of just see how you handle that, because actually, you know, doing this one to oneself is potentially more powerful than simply hearing it from coming from somewhere else when you actually... And who is this person you're seeing in the mirror anyway? Mm-hmm. You know, this is another interesting question which actually can intensify the whole question of what this self is mm-hmm. and who it is and who's actually experiencing it.
And does it have to be criticism that's coming from within you, or is it something you've heard from your mother, or...
You can intend on it. You don't really have to be caring, you know. But I mean, it would be better if we're heartfelt.
Don't be easy on your on that self.
You know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I was going to say your question, John, actually reminded me when I was at work some years ago. The first time I heard something like that was John Wooden was a UCLA coach. Very winning coach, and he said he had a quote: "Don't be affected by criticism or praise. It's a weakness to be involved in either." It's kind of paraphrasing that, and instead, looking back at it now, when you said that, it's got such a dharmic undertone because you like praise, you know, you get your chest out, and then the criticism. Oh, I have something to prove, and it really doesn't create that space you need to be an authentic leader. So I thought the question was, it had both ends of the spectrum for the self. Mm-hmm. You know, let's feed what feels good, and let's push away what doesn't feel good.
Right. One of the reasons I wanted to share that activity with you in particular is something that really struck me from Emma's talk. She says a lot of our journey in exploring selflessness is exploring that particular feeling where ego clinging, the emotional reaction of the self, is felt in your body as something that you can't bear to feel. Then in terms of attachments, it's more subtle in that we want things to last longer. So we actually feel the sense of, I'm hanging on to this and I don't want that. And that produces the permanent singular and independent. Which produces the habits, which produces the identities. And that brings us to 9 o'clock.